we're starting a new series this morning for Advent. Welcome to the mess. This morning, I woke up really early, as I normally do on Sundays, come in to do some prep work, and it was about 5:07. I had left my radio on pretty loud in the car, and I was reminded very forcefully by Amy Grant that it is the most wonderful time of the year, okay? So that's what we all, like, that's what we're supposed to think, that's what we're supposed to feel. And yet, I was in here, first service, talking to an older gentleman who has been coming to our church for a few years, and great guy who's going through some health issues, and he's widowed, and unprompted, before he knew anything about, you know, the series, he leans over to me and he says, "David, I really don't like this time of year." And it's because life is messy. And this morning I'm going to talk about loss in particular, something that this man has experienced some of. So I know it's supposed to be a great time of year, and it's supposed to be a lot of fun, but I just, quick survey, so I'm going to need congregational participation, okay? Limber up the shoulder, be ready to raise the hand, okay? How many of you have ever, for the Christmas season, had expectations here and reality here, unmet expectations? Just raise your hand if that's ever happened to you, okay? To most of you then, okay? How about this? How many of you spent too much money and were stressed out the next month because of how much you spent, because the bills came due? Wow. Financially savvy people here in New Albany for the most part. Okay, fine. Don't raise your hand on that one. How about this? You were hoping for a gift all Christmas season. You wanted that gift, and then you open up all the presents, and it wasn't there. Raise your hand if that's ever happened to you. Okay, now, how many of you wanted that gift? You wanted it so badly. You were waiting for it. Then you opened it, and there it was. And like a month later, you didn't care at all about that gift. Raise your hand if that's you. Okay, good. One more. How many of you can't wait? Like, you're just, you students are dying for winter break, for taking a break, sleeping in, hanging out with friends. And, you know, you adults, you get a week off or whatever, and you can't wait for that. And then it happens, and then it's so weird. Like, a week later, it's January, like, the 6th or whatever. It's dark at like 4 p.m., and you have a lot of work to do, and you're just depressed. Raise your hand if that's ever happened. Okay, good. That's happened. Not good, but thank you for participating. I don't mean that, but this is what this season is like. It's messy. I don't mean it's not a joy. It is. A lot of the aspects of, for me personally, or the Christmas season is a lot of fun. We had Friday night, we had our NAPC Christmas party. So we had like 120 people in this house, and we had a great time. Here are some of the pictures of the party. We have these three guys. They're all good friends. There seems, I don't know, there's like some pattern happening here. I'm not sure. It's maybe male pattern button-down shirts. I can't figure it out, but there's something going on there. We have couples enjoying themselves, and then we have particularly masculine men who can actually pull off the mustache. Bob and Jim were in the first service. They gave a hearty amen. But really, these are our hosts. So Sean and Rebecca Vidal. I mean, Sean's everywhere. He's up here playing guitar. He's hosting the party. So thank you very much, Sean and Rebecca. It was a great party. Had a great time. Amy Haseman also did a lot of the organizing, as did Mike and Carla Musi. So it was a great event. So there are things like that that, you know, we have during the holiday season, during the Christmas season. It's a blast. But isn't it sort of a mixed bag? I mean, there is the stress of trying to get all of the things done. And there's this brutal, like, regime of parties and schedules. And, you know, you're just, a lot of times, exhausted through all of the fun that you're having. And it can be filled with joy, but isn't it also the Christmas season tinged with some melancholy as well? I mean, we do a Christmas card every year, and, you know, we look at past Christmas cards, and we're just blown away by how fast. I mean, our kids were little, and now they're big, and it's sad in some ways. So The first thing I want to just acknowledge is that the mess of life is real. There are many people who would have you believe that life isn't messy, that it's if you just self-help yourself enough, you'll be able to get out of the mess. Like if you read the right book, apply the right principles to life, then everything's going to go fine and you won't have any struggles and it'll be one great thing after another. Now, I'm caricaturing that perspective a little bit, but not too much. I mean, you remember The Secret? That thing that if you just think positive enough, like, don't you think that's a little, like, do you think that would help people that are starving in Africa to tell them just think positively? I don't know. I don't think it would. So the mess is real. Life is hard. And the amazing thing is that it was really hard for the King of the Universe. So I'm going to read this passage. This is in Matthew chapter 2. And then we're gonna look at Matthew 2, 13 through 18. Now, this is the passage right after the one, if you were here last week, I talked about the three wise men coming to visit Jesus and you know, bowing down, worshiping him, giving these costly gifts to him. So this is right afterwards. Now, when they, the wise men, had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. And remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." That's King Herod. And Joseph rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. This is the word of the Lord. The mess is real in Jesus' life. If you read, one of the disciples was Matthew. He was a tax collector, and he was radically changed and converted to follow Jesus, became a disciple of his. And there's another disciple of Jesus's who wrote one of the Gospels. His name was John. He was Jesus's best friend. He was his closest friend. And when John opens the Gospel that he wrote, there is this incredible picture of who this Jesus is. And it's an eternal picture. This is what he writes. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." This is Jesus. The Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. "All things were made through him. And without him," Jesus, "was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." Nothing can overcome the light of Jesus in the world. There is darkness, though. There's darkness all around. And then if you go down to verse 14 in John chapter 1, it says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." That's what we celebrate at Christmas. We call it the incarnation. If you've heard that word before, that word carn is, it literally means meat or flesh. Like if you have queso con carne, you're putting a little beef in there. The incarnation means Jesus, the God of the universe, came in the flesh. So Jesus was born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago. He existed from eternity past. Now, if you were God and you were going to enter into the human story, wouldn't you do it a little bit differently than Jesus did? I would. I mean, if I could choose however, you know, I wanted to be born, you know what I would do? I'd be born in a palace back then. It would be a Yo MTV Cribs today. It would be a big house, either way. I'd be isolated. There'd be gates around my gates. I would have servants who rub my feet. I'd have a hot tub. I'd probably have a private jet that would take me wherever I wanted to go. I mean, just think if you could do anything in your life right now, what would you do? Life might look a little bit different right now. That's what Jesus could have done. But look at what he did. He enters into a very messy life. So messy, in fact, that the first real life event that he has is as a refugee. He has to flee his homeland for threat of death, and he goes to a foreign country. Now that, I think, in our day and age is fascinating. Because what has happened in the last couple months, we have these attacks in Paris. And then just this week in California, an immigrant opened fires at a place where they serve people with disabilities. And it's horrible stuff happening. And in the midst of this, we have calls from governors that they would never allow Syrian refugees to enter into their state. They would refuse them. And just think, Jesus was a refugee. Now, I'm not giving you the nuances of immigration policy because I don't know it and I have no idea, but I do have a very good friend, one of my best friend who I grew up with. He serves and leads a ministry in Charlotte that serves exclusively refugees. They serve Ethiopian communities and Vietnamese communities and several others. The nations have come to the cities, and Charlotte is one of them. And he wrote a piece, because he works with refugees, he wrote a piece and was interviewed by the local news station and kind of in the wake of what happened in Paris. And this is what he says. What I have wrestled with is this: what is the right response to the overwhelming refugee crisis in our world? And the cruel reality that the crisis can be exploited by the very perpetrators of the crisis itself. That's what happened in Paris. And more specifically, what is the biblical response to the situation? And then he goes on. He says, well, what's the great commandment? To love God and to love other people. How about the Good Samaritan? Who is he? Well, the priest saw this guy on the side of the road. He walked by. He was too busy. So did the scribe. So did the pastor. But the Samaritan, a foreigner, took care of him, put him in a hotel, and paid his way. And Jesus said, go and do likewise. And so my friend writes about those passages, and then he says, Dustin says, you can basically respond in two ways. One, you can respond with fear. Two, you can respond with a sense of purpose. Fear says this: we're closing our doors, we're skeptical of anyone who isn't like us, and we're going to focus on ourselves and our own well-being. It says this, and there are 51 million refugees. So imagine this. Imagine if you went home today and there was a mob around your house and they were burning your house because you are a Christian or because you're white or because you're black or whoever you are, and you had to leave. And you couldn't even stop at a gas station. You just had to go with whatever was in. You didn't bring any possessions. And then your car ran out of gas, but because you are who you are, you don't dare go to a gas station. And then you travel on foot to the border of Canada, and you can't get in. And so you're living in a tent that some aid organizations have given, and you get food when they tell you, you have no privacy. That is exactly the experience of 51 million refugees in our world. And this is what Dustin says. Three things. If we have a purposeful Christian response, we will, one, welcome and care for refugees in need. While two, refining and addressing and improving the process of verifying the legitimacy of refugees. And then three, having a larger engagement in fighting the systemic issues that cause people to become refugees in the first place. I don't know exactly what that looks like, what the details are of that. And if you said, how can I practically apply this to my life today, David? What are you saying? I'm not really sure. But I can tell you one thing you can do. This is something that our next door neighbors, or across the street neighbors rather, Jason and Donna Kirkham, they're members of our church. They, for Thanksgiving, they were hosting their family, and they decided to open up their home. And they had two Ohio State students who had come from India into their home. And they just had Thanksgiving with them. Kind of an eclectic collection of people. And they, on top of it all, these two were vegan. Like, happy Thanksgiving, you know? Like, what the heck do you do? You know, you can't. I mean, no turkey for you, buddy. So they had lentil soup. But was it a pain? I don't know. They said it was a blast. They said they thoroughly enjoyed it. So what can you do? You could probably do small things like that. You could probably open up your home to the sojourner, to the outcast. Jesus was an outcast. He was a refugee for the first few years of his life. His life was messy. Our life is maybe not that messy, but it's messy. We have a staff meeting every week, and one of us leads the devotion for the week. So we'll do just something we've been learning about, something that we've been studying, and I figured I'd kill two birds with one stone. It was my turn to lead, so I just read this passage, and my only question was, where is life messy for you right now? Oh my goodness, four of us on staff in this meeting, two have parents who are dying or in tremendous emotional turmoil, in tremendous difficulty. Pastor Mark's wife, Debbie, pray for her. She just had major surgery on her wrist and took some hardware out from a bad fall she had a few years ago, and tendon repairing, and she's in a lot of pain right now. Leah and I, you know, I've told you about how we've kind of journeyed through this adoption process. We thought we were going to adopt in November, and then it failed, and it was this fairly devastating experience for us. We just got a call this week that there was a child in Florida, and we thought about it, but the mother is addicted, and so it's going to be a multi-week stay in the hospital, and you know, Friday was the C-section last Friday, so yeah, probably can't be gone for the month of December. That would be a bad time to be gone. So, but it just brought up all of these emotions. So it's messy. We had our elders meeting Wednesday. One of our elders has had five family members die this year in 2015. It's messy. And we all have different messes in our lives. Rick Warren, he's a famous pastor in California, he likens it to, he says it's probably better than peaks and valleys in life. An analogy he uses is that it's like two lines on the same train track. And one of those lines represents everything that is good in your life that you can be grateful for throughout the day. But there's another track, on a single track in your life, and those are the things that are hard in your life. And you probably have those tracks going simultaneously, no matter who you are, throughout your life. There are good things happening, and then there are bad things happening. There's some of you students, maybe you're doing really well in school, and school is going well for you, but socially, you're just having a hard time. Or maybe your team is not doing very well. Maybe you're having a great time at school, but you're fighting with your parents. Like this happens to all of us. There are good things happening, there are bad things happening, and this is just part of life, because life is messy. And the reality is that it's not just messy. Loss is part of life in a fallen world. And I just don't want you to be surprised by this. I know you know this, but it's amazing. You know, going to Africa for a few times, I've been four times, and see these people who, they are in desperate poverty. I mean, no running water, they have no electricity, they're living in mud huts, and they have this deep sense of joy. How? Well, they know that life is messy, and they're grateful for what they have. That doesn't mean that they don't want to have electricity and running water. Those things are bad. I don't mean that, but I think in the West, in our culture, we just expect everything to go really well, and when it doesn't, it's very shaking to the foundation of our lives. And I'm not saying there's not room for that. There is. But life is hard, and loss is a part of living in a fallen world that is filled with sin and wicked people and evil. And look at what happens here. This is just a haunting passage. So the angel comes and tells Joseph, Jesus' stepdad, and they get out before Herod comes. But what about the other parents? I mean, Herod's soldiers come and murder these baby boys that are 2 years old and under. And I don't want to overstate this. They're probably somewhere between 10 and 25 baby boys. But still, one is tragic. I mean, why didn't God send an angel to all of the parents? Why didn't God strike Herod dead and exact justice on his wicked, evil heart? I don't know. And I don't think that, I think there are some things we're just not meant to know. Deuteronomy, the last chapter in Deuteronomy, I believe it's Deuteronomy 31, it says that the things that God has revealed to us belong to us and our children. But there are secret things of God. And I think that when we experience really significant tragedy, part of what we have to say is that we don't know. questions have been asked from Job all the way through to Jesus. Even Jesus asked questions about his own fate. My God, why have you forsaken me? God, take this cup from me. But not my will, but your will be done. And if we are fully understanding who God really is, then we will know that God's sovereign plan is good even when it doesn't feel like it. His plan is good. And his plan is not thwarted when bad things happen. It's not like you're hanging out there on a string, and if something bad happens, God was looking the other way, or having dinner, or using the restroom, and he just took his hands off the wheel, and oh man, I can't believe this happened. That's not our God. Our God is sovereign. He rules and reigns over everything. He controls everything. And so, we can know that whatever happens, God has sovereignly made it happen. And I want you to know where the Bible says this. Ephesians chapter 1. God works all things according to the counsel of his will. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things not yet done. And if you forget all of that, remember this one verse, Romans 8, 28. Okay? If you're a follower of Jesus, you need to know this verse. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. In all things, God works for the good. And I know that there are some things that happen in life that it's hard to make much sense of that. You know how two-year-olds, if you gave them their choice, all they would eat is candy? And they wouldn't go to bed either. They'd just keep going, and then they'd, like, completely pass out, and then they get up and keep watching cartoons and eating candy. We know that that's probably not good for them, so we tell them, and when we feed them broccoli, they don't like it. But we know that broccoli's good for them. And maybe we also want to punish them, so we give them broccoli. But long run, okay, we have a better view of this. We know that Laffy Taffy and Nerds are not going to nourish them. So we're finite, and the two-year-old and us, well, there's not that much of a gap. The gap between us and God is infinite. And I know this analogy breaks down. But we need to know that God is sovereign, that his plan is good, that no matter what happens, he works for the good of those who love him. And when we stand back and we look at the tapestry of the history of the world, we will say, glory to you, God. You are mighty and powerful. Thank you. We love you. We will say that. He is sovereign. His plan is good, even when it doesn't feel like it. Really, the hope that we have is in the mess. It's only through the Messiah. It's only through Jesus. If you look at these passages, we find the sovereignty of God because God predicted that these things would happen through his prophets. That's why it says in verse 15, what the Lord had spoken by the prophet Hosea, out of Egypt I called my son. And then later, skip down to verse 18, it says, through Jeremiah, another prophet. Both of these guys wrote hundreds of years before. So these are predictions in the scriptures that predict what's coming for Messiah. But they also are talking about God's people back then. And I want you to know that these passages that are so heartbreaking, about children dying, about Jesus being a refugee, if you read the context in the Old Testament, what you find is tremendous hope. Take the Isaiah passage, out of Egypt, I called my son. This is a reference to the people of Israel being freed from slavery and taken into Israel, into the promised land. And these people have been disobedient. They've turned their backs to God. They don't worship God rightly. They walk the other way. And this is God's heart for his people. This is what it says about God. Now he has every right to punish them. He has every right to distance himself from them. But this is what he says. How can I give you up? How can I hand you over, O Israel? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. No matter what you are going through, God has this tenderness and affection toward you. You may be feeling very guilty this morning about some sin in your life. I want you to know this haunting verse in 18. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. This is a reference to Rachel, who's the wife of Jacob. Jacob is one of the first fathers of the nation of Israel. They have 12 sons. They become the 12 tribes of Israel. That's who Rachel is. And yet this is also looking forward to what happens in this passage. And this is what it says in Jeremiah. Thus says the Lord, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for there is a reward for your work, declares the Lord. If you are faithful, if you keep walking with Jesus day by day, if you keep praying and reading His Word, if you keep reaching out to other people, if you keep serving and loving, it's going to be messy. There's no promise that life is going to go easy for you. But Jesus overcame the mess. He entered into it for us. And He overcame the mess so that we would have someone who walks with us through it. And so that we would have purpose in it. So that we would have the strength to love the people around us and serve the people around us as we walk through the mess. So my encouragement to you today is, no matter what mess you are in right now, there is hope and there is a Messiah that we have who entered into the mess to overcome it so that you and I might be forgiven of our sin and redeemed and set on a path where God uses us for His glory